Hey, you got the morning show with Aaron, and in the studio I've got Finn Maxig. Morning, Finn.
Good morning.
So we're here to talk permaculture, and this is our last one for the year.
Yeah.
I've been really pleased to be talking permaculture. We picked this up somewhere near the start of the year, I think, or a fair way in, and I was thinking, why don't, if this is Raglan, I should have a permaculture segment. And so it's been good to do it. And we've been, for those who've just tuned in or caught up with this idea, we've been going through the seven domains of permaculture, or the seven petals, if you look at the permaculture flower, the conceptual visual version. And what are we talking about today?
So today is building, or built environment.
Built environment.
And so this is the seventh domain that we... the seventh and final one that we'll look at, or I mean, they're not necessarily ordered in that way, but we've already talked through six of the different domains, and so nice to wrap up the year on building.
And it's interesting you said building and built environment, and that's really important, because often everyone designs their buildings carefully, but the built environment is all the leftover space in between.
That's right. Yeah. And so we are often talking about infrastructure, whether it's housing or community facilities, buildings, actual physical buildings, but also we're talking about things like I guess roads, bridges, and we'll get into this in more detail, but potentially even things like constructed wetlands or swales or some constructed features that contribute to the ecological health of a catchment or an area.
Okay, all right, anything we build, basically.
That's it.
Yep. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and so it's interesting because there's an overlap, you know, as there are with all the petals, but with this and, you know, tools and technologies, and to a certain extent even with land and nature stewardship and, you know, elements.
Yeah.
But we can get into that.
Yeah, okay. So how do you approach this?
Yeah, so
truck going past, folks, if you're wondering.
As noise. Talked about before, the flower is, I guess, a conceptual framework. And well, over the years, there hasn't been too much, I guess, literature exploring in great detail the seven petals. There is definitely, you know, quite a few breadcrumbs and some, I guess, kind of key concepts. And so for me, when I'm thinking about, in the context of permaculture, when I'm thinking about building, thinking about things like rebuildability and replaceability. So, you know, are we building something that we can continue to maintain and rebuild over time, or are we building something that is kind of a one-off? And, yeah, so that's one consideration. Another one is things like toxicity and long-term...
Actually, can I just step back in that? The New Zealand Building Code asks for a building to be... it has to meet the standard of lasting 50 years.
Yeah.
Which is two generations, give or take. But in the permaculture way of thinking, is that very long? That's what I wanted to ask.
Yeah, so I guess there's two ways of thinking about that. And one is, and we'll get to, or maybe now's a good time to talk about some of the other considerations, is where is the materiality coming from, and what's the workforce and the finances and all the rest of it look like? So as an example...
So when the context,
think,
really.
Is really important. So when we think historically, is... You know, I don't know, and I don't pretend to know. But what would be the lifespan of a traditional Māori whare? You know, I'm imagining that might last maybe a decade, but that was a non-issue because you'd be rebuilding them regularly, and you'd be focusing on the health and quality of the indoor living environment. And so, as soon as you had anything like rot or anything set in, then presumably, you know, there'd be a whole process in place where you could replace. So things necessarily needing to last for a very long time, I don't know. I mean, durability is a consideration, especially the more energy and materials invested in a particular built form, then it makes sense that, you know, you do want to focus on durability. But sometimes you actually, having something that's only going to last many years is okay. You know, so things don't have to last forever for them to be sustainable. Well, I think what's more important is replaceability, and having, so that includes everything from, you know, the skills and the labor force to the materials, the know-how, all of those things that go into being able to build any kind of structure, infrastructure to begin with.
Okay. All right. Let's go back to where
so
we were.
So does that make sense? So,
yeah.
But I will then
it's triggered,
share the...
It's triggered lots of questions in me, but we'll go back to where you were, I think.
Well, following that thread, though, I'll go to the other extreme of that, where You have buildings in Japan, wooden, you know, natural built materials or natural built structures that have been around for 600-700 years, you know, all completely natural. And they also have their own replacement cycles in terms of thatching and whatnot.
Yeah.
But those have been built for durability. But those, they're also civic buildings. You know, they're places of congregation and they're places of spiritual significance. So they, so a lot of surplus was invested into creating them, and presumably, you know, the best timbers were selected, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah.
And so those are almost two extremes, is you have these things that are, you know, reasonably perishable, but that's part of what's appropriate in that context. And so, you know, you have lots of people who can help rebuild regularly. And then the other side is you have a workforce and materials where you can maintain a much much more durable, much longer lived one. But having 50 years for a toxic building yeah, that's questionable, because that's somewhere in that weird middle ground, whereas generally speaking, modern builds have high toxicity
and high energy input as well.
High energy input, yeah. and very low, I'm making up a word here, I think, but disassemblability, the ability to take apart something, to deconstruct
these it. These days, yeah, because everything's glued together. Everything has to be glued.
So nothing can be, or very few things can be repurposed. So we're dealing with almost like this whole other category, which is how long before it becomes landfill.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas I think in the two examples I gave before is nothing, very little of that, if anything, would actually end up as a waste product. It would just either decay back into the environment or be repurposed as part of, you know, whatever it was, into a new structure, or used, repurposed for something totally differently. But you wouldn't have the same waste element. So I think that's quite a consideration.
Yep.
But I guess related to that is this idea of performance and, I guess, kind of effectiveness. So when we're building something, how well does it perform against what it's supposed to do?
Yeah.
And so, you know, when we think about modern homes, I guess, you know, not to pick on all the bad examples, but the leaky home syndrome of the, what was it, the 80s and 90s, and the implications that had.
Well,
is,
it came out in 2000s that hit the headlines.
Yeah, so I guess, and that was the impacts of the buildings that were built in the 90s. And
yeah.
I forget when the building code changes were made, but basically, as far as I understand,
might have been 91.
Okay, yeah.
I'm trying to think, because this is an industry I used to be in.
Yeah.
I remember sitting around in the office, and we were talking, like, our bosses were like, from now on, we're not going with the building code. We're putting treated timber around the bathroom and places like that, like, because the people who knew could see it coming.
Yeah, got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and so that's really interesting around the the building performance. So when we're thinking about buildings from a permaculture lens, is, are they going to do what we want them to do? Are they going to perform? And it's not just about, again, when we're talking about buildings, is structures. We also could be talking about infrastructure. You know, so if we're going to build a bridge, do we want it to last for 5 years, 50 years, 300 years? And then does it do what it needs to do as a bridge? You know, as so effectiveness, or I guess it's kind of performance, is actually quite a key consideration. And then for me, there's something around the local, like a place-based vernacular, which again is all but gone, I would argue, now in New Zealand. But is it made from locally available materials? This is, goes back into, I guess, the rebuildability element of it. But there's also, like, I guess, a cultural aesthetic, it's not quite the right word, but, you know, can we finance it locally? You know, is it affordable in a meaningful sense? And again, therefore, is that you know, an owner builder kind of arrangement? How does that, is there it's a jargony term, but is there a local enabling ecosystem that allows our buildings to be created from the place in which they're going to exist, or do they need to be created, financed, fabricated somewhere else and brought into site?
So one of the outcomes of the leaky building period was that the ability to, the owner-builder thing moved further away from that.
Yeah.
into, which is what we always get with a modern system, where there's a central authority that says you are qualified to do this and you are not, and so you can't touch it.
Yeah.
I mean, there still is owner builder stuff, but it just keeps moving in that, because they couldn't get rid of it entirely because the country survives on it.
Yeah.
And the building industry kind of relies on it to get some houses built or modified.
And from builder friends that I know, and so again, I'm not an expert in this space, but from what I think I understand about the building code, is the shift has been significantly towards industrial kind of manufacturing. And so the codes are less about building and more about the production of the materials used to build. And so the arguably anyway, the tail wags the dog there. So it's more about what materials can you use to build a house. And so builders are then kind of assembling the house with the materials that are on the certified list of things you can use. And so I think, so it's less about the shift currently is really about product control, what goes into the house, and less about, I guess, the functionality, the design, the quality of living spaces. And I'm not saying those don't matter, but I get an increased sense that that's not what drives our building industry right now.
Yeah, so a lot of the leaky building syndrome could have been avoided if people just put eaves on their houses.
Yeah.
Just the traditional 2-foot eave would have done the job.
And so bringing it back to, I guess, a permaculture lens is, you know, thinking about when we're talking about building, we're talking about infrastructure that really can enhance our way of life and doing so in a way that mitigates or minimizes any negative long-term impacts. You know, so it's about what do we build that increases our quality of life? And so obviously there's things we need, right? And there's things that we've always needed, like things like shelter. But then there are, you know, more modern and industrial versions of that. You know, so for example, you know, we need to think about quality urban environments these days, and how do we think about building towns or adapting and retrofitting and towns evolving in a way that adds to quality of life.
Mm.
And there's some challenges in there. So I guess some principles when thinking about, or I don't know if they're principles, but I guess heuristics or maybe they are more considerations, but things like passive solar design and climate responsive design. So how do we build buildings that heat and cool themselves and that respond to local climatic conditions, including things like prevailing winds, etc.? We build lots and lots of houses. We live in a pretty benign climate, relatively speaking. And we have the building technologies where we shouldn't really need to kind of power our homes to heat or cool themselves.
Mm. And that's not an outrageous statement. I had the experience, I designed a house for my parents years and years ago where the house barely needed any heating. Mm. And it was not a comprehensive solar house or anything. Like, it was not, you know, it was just keeping that in mind.
Yeah.
And I had just one little patch of tiles on a floor in a hallway that absorbed a lot of sun and it heated the whole slab. And it was
thermal mass. It's a really basic concept that is all but forgotten, I think. Where, you know, not, it doesn't seem to be widely understood as the benefits that simple concept can bring to quality internal environments.
Yeah, and it for folks who don't know, it stabilizes the temperature in the same way that the ocean stabilizes the temperature. Mm. The weather on the coast is never as hot as it gets inland or never as cold as it gets inland. Mm. And we all know about the frosts, which we don't get in Raglan, but as soon as you drive past the first couple of hills sometimes in winter, you'll see frosts.
Yeah,
so it's stabilizing ability.
We've talked about this a bit before too, but, you know, natural construction materials. So how do we think about...
Are there any?
Yeah, well, I mean, earth, lime plaster, stone, brick.
I was thinking conventional stuff. Yeah.
Timber, no. Yeah, so there are timbers. There are timbers that you can use that are part of code, but very few of them that don't have to be treated.
One of those would be Lawson Cypress, would it?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. But anything that's not standard pine is suddenly more expensive.
Yep.
As soon as the thing with the building industry, like, it is very efficient in a lot of ways, if you get the standard off the shelf stuff, it is considerably cheaper than doing anything a little bit different.
Absolutely, and that's where again I think that kind of toxicity lens becomes part of the consideration. But it is tricky because, you know, affordability is obviously important, and when we don't have a culture that has the collective skills required to build anymore, it does. The costs rise really quickly because we can't source the materials ourselves. We can't typically build ourselves. And so affordability, there are these trade-offs, so it does get tricky. Part of building, too, is things like water harvesting and water reuse. And so, again, we're moving outside of pure built form, but things like how do we capture the water that does fall, and then what kinds of things are we doing to reuse water and to treat water, and so moving again into some elements of tools and technology and land and nature stewardship, but you know, so thinking about stormwater, wastewater, potable water, and what do we build to allow us to manage all of those in an ecologically responsible way. And that's not always straightforward, especially once we start getting to larger and larger scale. But we're thinking about things like green infrastructure to help us with that. So constructed wetlands, what else fits into that space? We've got...
I was just thinking, like the way we've gone is to have the big system in the town, the stormwater system, where we take the rainwater and we put it into a pipe and create an infrastructure issue.
Yeah.
And then when inevitably somehow the water from the stormwater system, or the water that should be in the stormwater system, ends up in the sewage system, it doesn't overflow the sewage ponds, but they just let the sewage let the wastewater into the harbour on the incoming tide, because that's all they can do.
Yeah.
Because every time it rains intensely, the system gets overloaded. It gets overfloated. I think that's a good word for what's been happening this year. Everything's overfloated.
And so there is a challenge with scale and centralization. Just, I think, naturally, it just kind of happens. And so there, I think, is a lot to be said for decentralized systems in that regard. But it is a tricky one. I know David Holmgren, I've heard him say, centralized sewage is kind of a dead end, and it's never really worked, not really from an ecological point of view, and the sooner we abandon it, the better off we are, which is a challenging statement when we think about, well, then how do we get from where we are to a more ecological response, especially when, you know, we have this magical place called Away.
and our toilets are the perfect.
Are designed to flush everything away.
Wash it all away.
That's right. And so there is a culture shift and a value shift around reconnecting with, you know, things like wastewater systems, and how do we start conceiving of that, of nutrient cycles, and you know, so that gets beyond the building, but it is stuff we build to manage the way we live our lives. And if permaculture is focused around the infrastructure that can enhance our way of life, I don't think anyone here would say that a degraded harbor or a degraded coastline in terms of water quality and release of effluent and stuff increases the quality of life in any way, but it's kind of what we've got. How do we start rethinking?
The thing with that, the way we do that, is if you looked up, found your ecological principles, and then gone, what's a really bad way, using these principles, what's the worst way we could get rid of our human waste? You'd be hard-pressed to do anything worse than we're currently doing, to make it, in terms of making it complicated and difficult and counterproductive.
I would not disagree with that. we can see the ecological impacts of that. You know, I find it often funny how quick so-called kind of Western so-called advanced cultures and societies are to cast judgment on others, especially, you know, indigenous cultures, when our track record often in terms of the things we pride ourselves on, you know, like engineering, you look at often the outcomes of that and you go, I'm not sure that's something to brag about.
Yeah. Well, the engineering, once if you take the, ignoring the bad decision to put our poo in water in the first place, once you go there after that, the engineering is quite impressive. But that's because the problem is also equally substantial.
But the outcome is also impressive, but not in a let's applaud human ingenuity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a shake your head and go, really?
It's how we get ourselves out of trouble when there would have been a better way. I should want to mention, I've just had a text saying affordable housing's a myth, no such bloody thing.
Hmm.
Did we mention the phrase affordable housing?
I did. Well, I talked about how affordable is an important consideration.
Yeah, and we had this conversation before we started off the year about our houses are simultaneously unaffordable and also cheap in the sense that they're constructed cheaply in a way that doesn't answer a lot of the questions you're talking about how does this enhance human life.
Yeah.
But yeah, we do know at the time. And that's an economic question a little bit about why houses are so expensive now.
Well, so I think affordable housing does exist. But again, it comes back to a very different type of housing model and how we attain that, especially as a culture and as a location, is challenging. But it does require a flourishing natural environment where we actually have the resources we need to build. It requires a skilled community and a knowledgeable community who has skills to build in a local vernacular that allows people to have quality living environments. But it's a whole different model. And where it exists, it's because there are skilled people out there who are able to work with the materials available, and they're not having to pay market rates for, you know, everything they need.
The other thing is that you don't want to, if you can build outside of the regulatory system, which uses, in an attempt to make the houses safe and meet a certain standard, has created part of the system we've got now with quite expensive solutions.
Mm.
So you can build really cheaply if you build outside of that system, but you also have to build somewhere out of the, you have to go into hiding, you have to hide your house, which is not a very...
No.
Not easy for most people.
And what does that look like at a societal scale when everyone's trying to do that? It does remind me, though, of recently I've been talking to a lot of the permaculture pioneers, permaculture elders in this land as a side project trying to reconstruct, a narrative about, you know, the origins and early years of permaculture. And one of the comments that was made in one of our chats was, we need to bring back some of Bill Mollison's aphorisms and things like find out what's not illegal and do that. And so it kind of speaks a little bit to that point there of, you know, like there was definitely a rebel kind of spirit to Bill and how he thought about permaculture, which was, you know, kind of find that edge. And so it, you know, it speaks to the point about how do we think about building either on the fringes of or in the space in between the regulatory environment, so it frees us up. And I know people like Michael Reynolds, I believe his name is, the garbage warrior. He was really big on that, and he fought in the United States for laws about loosening up.
Have you seen the movie with
the regulatory? I've seen at least one movie, so I think it's probably the same one. Is that one called Garbage Warrior?
Yeah, and where he's ended up trying to change the system, create some legality where you could do test houses, and it got to quite an absurd point trying to get inside the system and change it.
I do think that's kind of what's needed. Is there does need to be the freedom for people to experiment. You know, as whoever texted in said, is affordable housing is kind of has become a myth. Well, what are the regulatory dials and levers that can be manipulated to allow for experimentation? There's a lot of really skilled, really clever people out there who are passionate about things like affordable housing. And I think there are pathways. It's just very, very difficult right now through the legal framework or, you know, by following the code to try to achieve these kind of outcomes that we're talking about.
Yeah, There's something about the regulatory framework. It ends up, it's supposed to enhance our lives, but it ends up inhibiting it at the same time. Things have got, like we used to, 100 years ago, people would build houses and they're still standing and they're fine and they, and I don't quite know what happened.
Well, and I think it's very, bureaucracy has a way of, you know, from a systems point of view, it builds on itself, and so it becomes self-reinforcing. It's a positive feedback loop, and so often regulations beget more regulations, because then you need to manage the regulations that you put in place. And so there is something about the natural process by which bureaucracy can run away with itself, and I think some of that happened. And at the end of the day, I think, you know, the intention is generally good in terms of wanting to ensure quality, wanting to ensure safety. You know, there's some principles behind where we've got ourselves that are desirable, I think, that most people would say, oh, yeah, that's, we understand why they've put that in place. But when you look at the mosaic of regulatory constraints, it's very hard to actually think about building with this idea of ecological and social cultural benefits, you know, exclusively as an outcome without any of the, a whole bunch of the downsides, like what typically emerges now is, you know, extraordinary amounts of debt, ecological toxicity that we'll having to be deal with for at least the rest of the century, but likely, you know, potentially centuries to come. We have ecological damage that's done by, you know, building the way we build. It's like when you look at all the externalities and all the negative sides, it's pretty overwhelming, really.
You talked before about the building and the vernacular, like in terms of what materials are available locally and what makes sense locally. But the vernacular for our building, if I want to keep using that word, is regulation and machine efficiency.
Yeah.
And that's what's determining more and more the shape of our houses, because as the building costs rise, we're going for more and more standardization. Mm. So everything's off the shelf.
And what's interesting about that, so the vernacular doesn't really exist in the sense that...
Well, the vernacular is a machine vernacular.
Well, sure it is, but I guess...
Which is not real. It's not
a place-based vernacular.
Yeah, it's a contradiction of the word vernacular, basically.
That's it, because you could go around the world and you could look at a lot of places and go, oh, this could be, you know, this could be anywhere.
Yeah.
There's nothing place-based about that. And I think it's because of exactly that, is because it, what's driving it. And so when we're thinking about building from a permaculture point of view, there is a place-sourced element that's almost inherent, is, you know, what's the climate, what's the materials, what's the resource base, what's the cultural values, and then what are the, and then putting all of those together, what are the kinds of infrastructure that we need? So again, we talked about this a little bit before, but, you know, things like the pataka, you know, we probably will always need somewhere to store our food. And so... Do we integrate those into our buildings, or do we? Does the future vernacular arrive at a similar place that Māori architecture arrived at, where they're standalone structures and they have
instead of having a house that we heat and then a fridge inside it to keep the food cold, which is fighting against the heat on the outside of the fridge.
It
makes more sense to do that. On the other hand, it's so convenient to have the fridge.
Yeah, but I guess cellars, you know, is a traditional. European, but from other cultures as well, where they've developed. Yeah, and you do have to walk to get there, and you know it's not
climb down steps.
Yeah.
But we're so into convenience now, almost dependent upon it. Mm. And like I had an experience a few years ago. We shifted into a house just before Christmas, and there wasn't time to get all the plumbing on, and so we didn't have a tap in the kitchen for 3 weeks, and we had to go to the bathroom, which was just across the hallway.
Yep.
But it was a massive pain in the neck not having running water in the kitchen. Mm. You know, like it just got really frustrating and annoying for 3 weeks over summer where we weren't even working. You know, like our lives was a relaxed life, but somehow it was extraordinarily frustrating. So,
and while I'm not advocating for that outcome, what I think is interesting is I think that was about expectation as well. Because, you know, when you compare that, and again, I don't mean any disrespect by this, but when you compare that to the daily life of, say, an African villager, or particularly...
Well, they have to go find a stream.
Yeah, so they're walking for 3 hours a day to get there.
Oh, I know. You know? Yeah, no, I totally agree. Like, that's why we're like, oh, it'll be right. No worries, because we thought that's just a few steps. But
and so in that permaculture realm, this is about, you know, ensuring that we have a quality living environment where things like accessible clean water are close by, close at hand. And so how can we build those into our structures? And so things like, you know, just simply water tanks is actually a really good start to that. And then whether we use some kind of biofiltration or we manage our use of that water, it seems like a no-brainer to me, even from a flood mitigation point of view, is if you could imagine if every house could store, you know, upwards of, 15, 20,000 liters of water, you take a lot of load off a large rain event quite quickly.
So, you'll enjoy this. If in the last, when were we doing? About 15 years ago or more, the regional council said that all new builds or they had to have a rainwater retention tank. Part of the purpose was to stop water flooding the system when there was a heavy rain event, and part of it was to have water on site. Then the district council's lawyers, this is my memory of it, the district council's lawyers and the district council who implement the building code and do the building checks, their lawyers said, advised it would be less of it would be less risk to not connect that water up to the house and not make people connect it up to the house. So for the council wanting to avoid liability, which is something that really drives councils, they said, okay, you've got that water, don't connect it up to anything.
So you still need to store it, but we you need to use it externally only. So you can't use it for washing machines or showers.
So most people have got 5,000 liters sitting on their site that does nothing. It just sits there.
And I'd still say better that they have it, because from a...
in an emergency, you've got some water.
That's it. So, I mean, it's still better to have than not, but it is interesting, how there's a bit of a... What gets in the way of being able to live more ecologically, more in tune, is, you know, there's a lot to be said for bureaucracy and regulatory barriers. And I get why they're there, but when you stand back far enough, they don't really make a whole lot of sense to me.
Well, that's a culture thing. That's a fear of liability for councils, but also based on the fact that they can't afford to be liable for stuff anymore.
Yeah, I think there is that. Yeah. So that's where, you know, finance and economics, we loop back into that pedal pretty quickly.
Yeah. Hey, folks, we're talking to Finn McAsee here, we're talking permaculture, the built environment. How much of your notes did we get through, Finn?
Oh, like a third of them?
A third. And you thought it was going to be more simple, this one. Is there anything you want to mention about the permaculture's view of building and built environment before we go? That you should feel like definitely should have mentioned. He's now combing through his list. No.
I mean, if people are looking for a pretty cool Christmas gift out there, a book that I've come across in the last couple of years that I think is awesome and touches on both building and, I guess, tools and technologies is Low Tech, Designed by Radical Indigenism. And it's just a book that I love. It's by Julie Watson.
Yeah.
And that explores how... I'd say low energy societies, you know, societies don't have access to diggers and, you know, a lot of the amazing energy dense tools and technologies that we do, how they have solved issues around infrastructure development working with nature.
So there's some smart solutions in there.
Oh, brilliant.
Because we can brute.
Intergenerational stuff that has evolved, you know, it's cultural wisdom that's been built over and the. And they pass on the knowledge of not necessarily how to build from scratch, but how to maintain and evolve the infrastructure that they've developed. Very, very cool.
Yeah, because of course we can brute force so many solutions these days that we don't need to be too smart.
That's right.
Yeah. All right, Finn, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you again sometime next year. I'm having a good month off the air at least. So
enjoy it.
Yeah,
well earned.
We'll see you then.